My Sunday, since I started coming here in the 1990s, is the third Sunday of the month. Now, every once in a while, that gets changed around. I didn't preach last month because I was out of the country. This next month, I'm going to be preaching on the second Sunday. But typically, I'm preaching on the third Sunday, which means that I never preach a Mother's Day sermon here, which Shelley's happy about. I'm not trekking her out here for Mother's Day. But I think I've always preached on Father's Day, or at least as long as I've been in the country, and I've been here in California, I have preached Father's Day on Father's Day. Now, it also is the case that I don't think in all that time I've preached very many Father's Day sermons, and I'm gonna keep with that tradition. I think it's a little bit vainglorious, or more importantly, since I have a couple witnesses here that can attest to the truth of the matter, is I'm not going to put myself in a situation where somebody might want to dissent, raise a hand, and say that's not accurate. We are doing something I don't know that we've done in quite a while here at Sierra Madre. We have a group of us who are preaching are working in cahoots with each other to put together a series of sermons on the Gospel of John. And Doug started this off last week with a sermon on John chapter 1. And if all goes according to plan, I know that Doug is one of the conspirators, I'm one of the conspirators, Tim Willis will be preaching here next weekend. We'll be preaching also from the Gospel of John. And I think we've roped Jack Scott into this as well. So we're we have a series unfolding. I don't know how long it's going to take us, but it's unfolding through. And we've chosen the Gospel of John in consultation with John Reed, and because we know that the Sierra Madre Church is going through a time of thinking about how to relate to, and not just thinking about it, but wanting to reach out to its neighborhood and really have a presence here in this part of Sierra Madre. And so we've come up with this sermon series where we're looking at the way that God comes into the story of the Gospel of John, really comes into Israel. And so what John focused on, or part of what John focused on last week, was John chapter 1, verses 10 through 13, where it says that he was in the world, but the world did not know him, even though the world came to be through him. And he came to his own place, but his own people did not accept him. But to those who do accept him, he gives the power to become children of God. And it's talking about Jesus coming to his own neighborhood and finding that not everyone, in fact, the majority of people don't accept him, but to those who do accept him, there is this opportunity, this power, this privilege, this license, this something miraculous that enables people to become God's children. That's what we offer here. That's why we're here. We're here because we have become children of God, and we exist in it's not just simply something for us. This is God's offer for all people, including our neighbors, including all those people that we encounter, whether at work or at the grocery store or just as we're walking along the street. This is the gospel, that to those who accept Christ, they become children of God. Now, in the Gospel of John, one of the things that we're going to notice is that Jesus comes into our world and has an uneven success rate. Some receive him, some don't. And there's conflict and tension. But there's also a persistence in his mission that's important to observe. And in the Gospel of John, after the beginning of the Gospel, after the beginning sort of opening prologue, the opening sort of description of how the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, after that, we hear the story of John the Baptist. And John the Baptist people come to hear him preach out in the wilderness. And as he's preaching and as he's baptizing, there comes Jesus. And John says of Jesus, "Behold the Lamb of God." And a couple of John's disciples start to follow Jesus. And then the way the story unfolds is we have Jesus beginning to have a gathering of disciples with him. And I want to, this morning, I want to focus on chapter 2 and the beginning of chapter 2, but I want to start a little bit early just to look at the fact that Jesus goes to Galilee in verse 43 and he finds Philip and he says to Philip, "Follow me." And Philip finds Nathanael. And we find out later on in chapter 21 that Nathanael is from Cana of Galilee. Okay, and so Nathanael comes to Jesus, and Jesus knows where Nathanael was. He knows about Nathanael. Nathanael beholds this sort of the fact. He's astonished that Jesus knows him, and they've never met. And Nathanael says to him in verse 48, "Where did you get to know me?" And Jesus answered, "I saw you under the fig tree before Philip called you." Nathanael replied, "Rabbi, you're the Son of God. You're the King of Israel." And Jesus answered, "Do you believe because I told you I saw you under the fig tree? You will see greater things than these." And he said to them, "Very truly, I tell you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man." Now, that sets the stage for chapter 2 and the story of the wedding at Cana in Galilee that I read earlier before the prayer. And it's important to understand that that story of the wedding at Cana of Galilee is not just by itself. It's part of a narrative. It's part of an overarching story that John is telling. And it's connected specifically with what's happened in the calling of Philip and Nathanael. And it's you see it in the very first verse of chapter 2. 3 days later, that means that John is holding together the unfolding of the story. And he wants us to see that this happens in the context of the calling of the disciples. Those disciples see Jesus, meet Jesus. They're astonished by Jesus. And Jesus says to them, "You're going to see greater things than what you've already seen. It's not just simply that I know you. You're going to behold signs and wonders," or signs. "You're going to see greater things." And then he says, "You're going to see the Son of Man," where as a sort of stairway to heaven. This is a kind of opaque allusion to something that happens way back in the story of Genesis, in the story in Genesis of Joseph and his dream. Do you remember that dream where Joseph, in the middle of the, I was going to say he wakes up, but it's a dream, so he didn't wake up. Where Joseph in his dream sees a ladder into heaven, or a stairway into heaven. He sees angels and descending and ascending, coming up and down. And Jesus picks up that dream and he says, "You're going to see something like that, except the means of ascending and descending into heaven will be the Son of Man." It's kind of strange. Right? So that's all going on. You can just imagine these handful of disciples wondering what they've gotten themselves into. They're excited. You know, "This is the Messiah," says Nathanael, but they're also perplexed. And now we come to this wedding, the wedding at Cana. And Cana is probably, you know, a few miles from where Jesus grew up. It's just a few miles from Capernaum. It's not very far from Jesus' home. And so in a sense, it is his neighborhood, right? So we're not surprised then when we pick up the story and it says that there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee and the mother of Jesus was there. And it then mentions that Jesus and his disciples also had been invited to the wedding. So we have this wedding, and we have Jesus' mother there, And we're not sure what she's doing, whether she is she's helping out or she's one of the invitees. We don't know who this is. I will point out that Nathanael, according to chapter 21, Nathanael's from Cana. And so maybe this is somebody that Nathanael knows. And Jesus and his disciples are invited. It's just that's the scene for what's going on here, is this wedding. And the basic story is familiar. It's in fact almost a trope. If we talk about the things that Jesus did, one of the things that you'll hear, whether you go to church or not, you'll hear this, that Jesus turned water into wine. Mostly because those of us who like wine really like this story. We think, well, this is Jesus, you know, sort of validating our preferences here. And then there are others who, of course, have an issue with whether we should be drinking wine or anything alcoholic. And so this has been part of that discussion. I don't think that when John sits down to write this, this is a concern of his. If we go back and we look at the ancient world, the world of Jesus, drunkenness could be an issue. But most people drank wine, usually wine diluted with water. And some of you are probably shivering thinking, that's not how you drink wine. But you know, that's how they drank wine. But what I want to point out is that this story is not simply a story about Jesus doing a magic trick, doing one thing, sort of working a wonder. This story is about something else. It's not the miracle. It's not the miraculous portion of the deed that we should focus on. It's these other details, and it's what Jesus is accomplishing through the miracle, right? We usually focus on the miracle, and we say, wow, he turned water into wine. Doesn't he know that's not supposed to happen? Don't you know you're not supposed to do that? Or look at how powerful he is, or look at how wonderful he is. And we could spend time focusing on that. And in fact, that's not just something that we would look at and say, look at this miraculous deed. It's something going on in the world of John as he writes this gospel, in the world of Jesus as he lives out this story. There were Greek gods and goddesses who had similar powers, and specifically there was the god of parties, the god who we associate with sort of wild drinking parties. In Latin, his name is Bacchus, and we get the name Bacchanalia from him. In Greek, his name is Dionysius, and Dionysius was the god of wine. And he was known, one of the stories is of him turning water into wine. And so there's some discussion, is John sort of juxtaposing Jesus over against Dionysus? And of course, you have the YouTube set, the people online who are saying, well, this isn't really a news story because Dionysius did this. See, this is just copyright infringement by the early Christians, just stealing stories from the gods and associating them with Jesus. That's a bunch of hooey both ways, right? It's clear that John... it lives in a world where gods are associated with these types of things. But that's not John's belief, that Jesus is just simply an ethereal being who's sort of coexisting in our presence, but, you know, slips back and forth between our reality. Jesus is the Word who became flesh. And what's more, we always have to remember that Jesus' purpose, his end goal, right, is not just simply an occasional deed of miracle, occasional miraculous thing. His end goal, right, is to be glorified on the cross. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But here we have the details of the miracle or the story really are something that we should focus on. And all the times I've read this, I've always sort of rushed through it and have thought, okay, Jesus turned water into wine. That's his first sign. What's next? What's the next sign? But why did he do it? Why did he turn the water into wine? Not just because he could, but there's something else going on here. And that's what I want to stop and look at. The story really begins for us in an observation that John makes and a comment that Jesus' mother makes. The observation that he makes is that when the wine gave out, verse 3, the mother of Jesus said to him, they have no wine. That's the observation I want to stop for a moment and think about. It's that the wine has given out, meaning they've run out of it. Now, at that point, right, what happens? Do we just simply say, well, okay, party's over, it's time to go home, there's no more wine? What's the significance of this? We've got, let's see, coming up, I have this weekend, some good friends of ours are getting married this Sunday. And so a couple of us are helping out with that wedding. And then we're thinking about that and talking with them about that. And then the next weekend, we have Shelly and I are going to one of my former students. He's getting married. And apparently, we're supposed to go down to Newport Beach, be there by 5:30, because the wedding is taking place on a boat, right? Now, when I start to think about, I'm just going along for the ride. I mean, literally. But I start to think about some of the details here, and I'm thinking, okay, you got a boat. Hopefully the weather works out. You know, hopefully people don't get seasick. I mean, I don't know where that boat's going to go, but hopefully it's not out on the open ocean, because that would be bad. I mean, I certainly will not be your ideal guest under those circumstances. We need to bring some seasick medicine or something. But then you just think about all the work that goes into planning weddings. And Shelly and I are going to Kansas City in August for another wedding. A couple of our students are getting married, and they asked me if I could officiate. And so I'm excited, you know, to go even to Kansas City. And apparently they've got good barbecue, so I take that back. I'm looking forward to it. So I'm thinking a lot about weddings this summer, and I'm thinking about the kind of work that brides and bridegrooms put into planning these weddings, right? What would happen if, right, you know, the DJ doesn't show up? What would happen if the caterer doesn't bring the food? What would happen if, you know, the flowers aren't there, right? Think of the frustration and the stress that would happen, right? Well, in ancient times in Jewish weddings of the period, what would happen is they didn't really focus on these big ceremonies as much as they focused on the celebration. That was the big to do. And so when somebody got married, they would spend several days having a great big party, and everybody would be invited. And the bridegroom and his family would put on this big party, so everybody's to come. Right? And the thing that's going on in the ancient world is it's a world of honor and shame. And one of the main ingredients in an honor-shame world is hospitality. One of the main things going on. And so the way that I show honor to you is to, when you come to visit, I open up my house to you. Right? And that not only shows you honor, but it reflects on my honor, on my status. Right? And my reputation in the ancient world, your reputation is everything. And the very last thing you want to be known for is the person who ran out of things at the wedding, especially something like wine. Right? Now, again, this is not like a drunken revelry that lasts for, I mean, they're mixing the water and the wine, but it's also not completely diluted wine, because as we find out a little bit later on, the custom is, you know, that as people go along, they do tend to, you know, feel the effects of the alcohol such that their ability to discriminate about good, bad wine, you know, has diminished over time. Maybe that's just because after a certain amount of time of drinking whatever, you just can't tell. But for whatever reason, it does have an effect. Now, when John tells us they've run out of wine, we should stop and go, oh my goodness, the florist didn't show up. Oh my goodness, right? The minister didn't show up. This is bad. This is like a significant problem in how they're going to carry this off. And so then when Mary says they have no wine, this is just not just a casual observance, or even worse, are different, you know, finally we can go home, right? You know, she's saying, they have no wine, let's go. This is not that. This is somebody who, in that culture, is thoroughly aware that this is a problem. This is a catastrophe. And so she says to Jesus, they have no wine. You have people who are wanting to be hospitable, people who are wanting everyone to come, people who are wanting to open up, right, their home to all of their neighbors, and they have no more wine. What happens? What will the neighbors say about them, right? For years, this will be the party that ran out of, this will be the wedding party that ran out of wine. For years, this will be the people that are associated with a failed attempt at hospitality. And again, in certain cultures, and we, because we live in our own culture, we don't think enough about this, but we were having, Shelley and I were in Jordan, and we were having a conversation with a friend of ours who's lived in the Middle East for 35 years, Middle East and North Africa. And he and the couple, they were recalling one time they had set up a dinner with somebody to come over. And something else happened, and because this was pre-internet, and these people didn't have telephones or anything, and so they didn't know, they didn't have confirmation they were coming over, and something happened, and so the wife had to leave and go someplace else. And they showed up. They showed up, and they weren't there. Right? The wife wasn't there, and the husband had to figure out how to navigate this. And of course, this became a big step back in developing this relationship. And it took a long time to repair the sense of the image that the person developed. You invited me to your home, and you weren't there. And that would be what's happened here. You invited us to your home for this party, And you didn't provide for us. You didn't provide for us. How do you come back from that? That's why when Mary says, the mother of Jesus says, they've run out of wine. Now, no wedding is complete without awkward family dynamics, right? You always have something going on that, hopefully it's not in the foreground, but you always have something going on where, family members are not getting along or something odd is happening. And the interesting thing about this wedding is we have some awkward family dynamics going on between Jesus and his mother, right? And that it's a good thing this is not Mother's Day, because we can talk a little bit about this awkward dynamic. What happens is Mary says, the mother of Jesus says to Jesus, they've run out of wine. And Jesus looks at her and says, woman, what is this to me and to you? Now, it's fun to go back and read commentaries and figure out, all the different theories about what's happening here. Why does Jesus call his mother woman? What is that? Is that how you spoke to your mother back then? Is that a term? It's not. In fact, it's a kind of distancing term. Why would Jesus do that? And then what does he mean? The Greek phrase is literally, what to me and to you, which sounds pretty simple, but when you try to translate it into a functional English phrase, it's really hard to figure out whether Jesus is saying, what do you want me to do about it? Or what can I do? Or if he's saying, this has nothing to do with me. Don't get me involved. And then the third thing that Jesus says is, my hour has not yet come. So we have this odd situation. We have Mary recognizing, hey, they've run out of wine. She says it to Jesus. We don't know if she was making a request. She probably was, but she could have just been saying, they've run out of wine. Jesus saying, woman, why are you bothering me about this? My hour hasn't come. Right? So what do we do with that? I think the one thing to notice is the word hour. In the Gospel of John, as we read on, what we'll discover is the word hour could refer to just simply Jesus' public ministry, but it most likely refers to the hour of his glorification, the hour that he's glorified on the cross. As we go along, that's how Jesus refers to hour. He talks about his hour has come when he's to be glorified on the cross. So he's talking about his crucifixion. And it's possible that what Jesus is saying here is, woman, and again, I don't know why he doesn't call her mom, but woman, do you realize that this starts a process? This is the beginning of the end. By doing this, I'm moving toward my death. I'm not sure, but I do know that for Jesus, every step is toward the cross. No matter how far away it seems to be moving in the opposite direction, every step for him is toward the cross. And this becomes sort of the public moment because people begin to talk about this sign. This is the first sign, John tells us, that Jesus worked. And it sort of sets us up to watch him with his disciples. Now, don't know what Jesus is trying to get across. Don't know why this is an awkward engagement. What I love about it is the fact that his mother doesn't stop to pay any attention to him and just basically says to the servants, do whatever he says. Right? Have you ever had that conversation with your mother where you're trying to explain to her, you know, I'm not really going to do this. I'm not going to do this. And she says, yeah. Okay, get ready. He's going to do it. Right? Because that's what she does. I mean, she just completely, you know, just she hears him but doesn't hear him and then plans on her own plans, her own sort of solution to the matter. So she says, get ready, right? I have a couple children who are being triggered by this conversation right now. She says, get ready and do whatever he says. Now, standing there were 6 stone water jars for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 to 30 gallons. Big stone jars holding 20 to 30 gallons of water, probably for either bathing or washing of hands, but they're huge, and there's 6 of them, right? And we're not entirely sure what these are doing other than. And some people think that this is some kind of allusion to how Jesus comes along and moves away from the old law and something with respect to Judaism and how he surpasses it. It's possible. There's a lot of things that go on later in the Gospel of John that have that kind of replacement motif where Jesus is, he is the new temple. He is the manna from heaven. He is the light of the world. He does these things where he's replacing or fulfilling what Judaism is pointing to. It's not clear that that's what's going on here. At the very least, what John wants us to know is there's some huge jars that are empty. And Jesus says to the servants, go and fill those jars. Okay. Now, they go, they fill the jars, and he says, take a little bit of the water, draw some out, and take it to the chief steward. So they took it, and when the steward tasted the water, it had become wine. At this point, we have to think about where we are. We've been at the wedding for several days. We're going to find out in a moment that it's that this is well into the wedding, right? And Jesus turns water into wine, but he doesn't just do a little bit, right? It's not, and it's, okay, so think about like milk, right? You go and you get a gallon of milk, right? So now I've got a gallon of milk, multiply that by 20, right? Or 30. So imagine 30 gallons of milk, right? That's probably going to be, that's more than enough for all of us, right? Right? Especially I don't like milk, so you can have mine, right? Now multiply that by 6, right? So now we're looking at 6, so we got 20, let's say 20 jugs of milk. Then we're going to multiply that by 6. So now we have 120 jugs of milk, right? Or at most 180 jugs of milk. I was doing the math. This comes out, if we're talking about wine and bottles of wine, this comes out to somewhere between 600 and 900 bottles of wine that Jesus provided for this wedding, right? 600 to 900 bottles. I don't care how many people they have, this is more wine than they need, right? This is an abundant amount of wine. This is a super abundant amount of wine. This is just showing off, okay? This is, you want wine? I'll give you wine, and the trucks come in delivering wine, right? Now, but it's not just that he provides wine. when it's brought to the chief steward would be like the person organizing the party, making sure everything, for us, it's the wedding coordinator, but if the wedding coordinator was also handling the reception, right? And handling, making sure everything, so this is the wedding coordinator. They go to the wedding coordinator, and they bring this wine, and the wedding coordinator tastes this wine, and the wedding coordinator says to the groom, hold on a second. Everybody waits until, you know, as the party goes along, they bring out the, you know, basically you start with like the really nice, you know, expensive wine and the champagne. And then by the time you get to this stage of the party, it's the $3 chuck. It's the stuff that you get, right, from Trader Joe's that is $3. And you bring it in and nobody cares, right? And again, it's not that they're completely drunk out of their mind. It's just they've had so much food and whatever that it just doesn't matter. That's what you typically do. But here, you've saved the best for last. You've saved the best for last. You've brought out this amazing, delicious, wonderful wine, right? And this wedding coordinator, this chief steward, he's been at weddings before. He's tasted the best. And this is the best of the best. What I want us to think about as we think about this story unfolding is how hospitality is working in the ancient world. Hospitality is huge, as I've said, and there's always a risk that something will go awry. To be hospitable is to make yourselves vulnerable. To open up your doors, to encounter different people, to allow them in. And even when you're trying to put on your best, you always run the risk of having some food on, you know, dry food on your fork or a smudge on a glass, or even worse, having something run out or some faux pas or something. Hospitality takes work, right? It takes a lot of work to open up yourselves to others. But when you do it well, when you've invited guests for dinner and everything goes swimmingly and they're enjoying themselves and you're enjoying them and you're enjoying the experience, it's sort of wonderful to have that feeling, that joy of successful hospitality. We're thinking about how do we engage the world around us, our neighbors. And it's hard work to reach out to people. It's one thing to reach out to people that you know. But here, as God's light in this community, in this neighborhood, we're reaching out to people that we don't know. We're asking them into our lives. Even if we go out to meet them, we're being hospitable. We're doing things for them. We're opening ourselves up for them. We're taking risks. We should be anyway. That's what love is about. But it is a risk. And it's a risk that comes with great rewards if it's successfully carried off. But it also comes with a challenge of what happens if we fail at reaching out to people. And this is where, like the bridegroom, we can take great joy in the fact that we have in our presence Jesus. I think it's interesting how at the end of the story, right, it's about the chief steward. The servants know that Jesus has turned water into wine, but the chief steward doesn't. And so who does the chief steward go to? He goes to the bridegroom, the host of the party, and he says, this is amazing. This is not something that people typically do where they bring out the best for last, but you've done that. And it's almost as if the chief steward never knows. The bridegroom probably knew, right? But he didn't say anything. He didn't say, oh, wait, no, this is Jesus. But there's something about the fact that Jesus is present here this morning in this community. He is here. And what is he doing? What can he do? What will he do? He will take our efforts to reach out to people, to embrace them, to welcome them in to our community. He will do that. He will turn water into wine. We have to trust him. We have to be like his mother, right? We have to be persistent in asking him and trusting, too, that he's going to do it. We have to be prepared, like the servants, to go and just do what he says. He wants us, we're out of wine, and the man wants us to put water in barrels, water in jars. I'm a servant. I'm just going to do it. I'm not going to ask why. But I'm going to marvel at what he does, because he will turn this water into wine. And I love the timing, too. I think that's really important. This is not the beginning of the party. This is toward the end. This is when things seem like they're going to be wrapping up, or it's really maybe if they do run out of wine, it's too late to salvage it. But at that last moment, Jesus comes in and provides more than enough. 600 to 900 bottles of the best heavenly vented wine you can imagine. No matter how late in the game it seems, Jesus is still capable, still present with his power to bring abundant life here as we reach out and we engage people. We need to trust in his presence. That's the bottom line. We need to trust in Jesus' presence, because if we trust him, then we'll have the peace and we'll have the resolution to go out and to love others and to reach out to others and to invite others, because we know that no matter how much we might not be certain or confident in ourselves, in our community here, our church community, we know that Jesus is present and he can do wonderful things here. John concludes by telling us, Jesus did this, the first of his signs, in Cana of Galilee and revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Jesus revealed his glory. Jesus' glory is not in miracle working. His glory is, in this passage, bringing hospitality, restoring hospitality, making a wedding into a true celebration. His glory is in giving of himself to his people and to the world. That's Jesus' glory. And the thing that stands out is those disciples, right, who first encountered him and have followed him and with him have been invited to this wedding. They're sitting there and they're watching Jesus, and they believed in him. They didn't know exactly what he was talking about. They didn't understand completely. We know that over and over again. We'll see. They don't always know what Jesus is up to, but they believed in him and they stayed with him. We are Jesus' disciples. He is present among us, and he is working these miraculous, wonderful, powerful things where he is enabling us to care for and love people. Our challenge, our joy, our purpose is to believe in him, to trust him. Consider the wedding at Cana in Galilee and the joy of Jesus' presence as we stand and we sing.